Good afternoon. My name is Scott Rosenblum, and as a partner at Kramer, Levin, Neftalis, and Frankel, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this event. We are very pleased that R. James Woolsey will address us today. Before turning the floor over to Ziad Abdel-Nour, who will introduce Mr. Woolsey, I would like to take a moment to tell you about the Middle East Forum's important work and encourage you to join its efforts. Under the direction of Daniel Pipes, the Middle East Forum works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. It has consistently displayed an unparalleled grasp of key issues, whether exposing the threat posed by radical Islam, working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel, urging the Bush administration to better manage its democracy efforts, thinking through strategies to contain the Iranian threat, or critiquing the extremist orthodoxy that dominates Middle East studies at North American universities. Through research, publishing, media work, and public education, including today's program, the Middle East Forum energizes the public debate by addressing a range of issues and by offering fresh and sound perspectives on policy. If you have not done so already, I encourage you to add your name to the email sign-up sheet to receive the forum's materials as they appear, or you can go directly to the forum's website to sign up and to read our work. I do hope you find the Middle East Forum's efforts worthy of your support. I ask that you please switch off all cell phones and pagers and hold all questions and comments until the question and answer session led by Daniel Pipes that will take place after Mr. Woolsey's talk. And now let me say a few words about Ziad Abdel-Nour, who will introduce Mr. Woolsey. Ziad is a New York-based financier and venture capitalist who serves as president and CEO of Blackhawk Partners, which specializes in global energy, general services, and the technology sectors. He's a founding member of the Forum's New York Board of Governors, on which I also serve. In addition, Ziad is a founding member and president of the U.S. Committee for a Free Lebanon, a coalition of Americans of all faiths that educates the public about Lebanon's strategic importance as a U.S. ally and an outpost of Western values in the Middle East. In 2000, Mr. Abdel-Nour co-authored with Daniel Pipes the book Ending Syria's Occupation of Lebanon, the U.S. Role. It is my pleasure to turn over the floor to Ziad Abdel-Nour, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Scott. Great to see you all here. Lots of guests, lots of friends. James Woolsey, former director of Central Intelligence, is currently a vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. He has served in the U.S. government on five different occasions, holding presidential appointments in two Republican and two Democratic administrations. His co-chairman, former Secretary of State George Shultz of the Committee on the Present Danger, and serves on the National Committee on Foreign Policy. Mr. Woolsey has also served as ambassador to the negotiation on conventional armed forces in Europe, Under Secretary of the Navy, General Counsel to the U.S. Senate Committee on Armed Services, and Delegate at Large to the U.S.-Soviet Strategic Arms Reduction Talks and Nuclear and Space Arms Talks. Among his numerous affiliations with public and private institutions, Mr. Woolsey is the Chairman of the Board of Freedom House, the Chairman of the Advisory Boards of the Clean Fuels Foundation, and the New Users Council, and a trustee of the Center for Strategic International Studies. Mr. Woolsey's articles have appeared in such publications as the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Financial Times, Los Angeles Times, and USA Today. Sought after for his dynamic speaking, he's a frequent media commentator, having made appearances on CNN, Fox News, and other major networks. He's one of today's leading experts on subjects of foreign affairs, energy, defense, intelligence, critical infrastructure, protection, and resilience. In recent years, Mr. Woolsey has published and spoken extensively on the topic of energy. In today's briefing, Mr. Woolsey will treat the question of American vulnerability due to dependence on foreign oil, especially in light of terrorist threats to our energy infrastructure and the steps Americans can take to protect themselves. And now, please join me in welcoming James Woolsey.
Thank you, Zed. I was, of course, quite honored when the forum asked me to be with you today, but to tell you the truth, since I spent 22 years as a Washington lawyer, and then I spent some time at the CIA in the Clinton administration, I'm actually honored to be invited into any polite company for any purposes at all. I am sometimes asked why I kept leaving a perfectly fine law practice, which I really loved as a litigator, to keep going in the government all those times. And any of you who served in the government know the reason you go to work for the government. It's two things. First of all, it's the big bucks. And then, of course, it's the public appreciation. I had a clear example of the second when I'd been in the job about 8 months at the CIA, and my wife and I, who were classmates at Stanford, decided we would take off 3-day weekend and fly out to California, go to a class reunion, see some old friends, cash in the old frequent flyer miles, go first class, do it right. Well, the first thing that happened is my head of security at the CIA said, Mr. Director, we actually want Mrs. Woolsey to fly on a different plane because we don't want anybody named Woolsey on the plane. And I said, but my name's Woolsey. And they said, no, sir, you need to fly an alias. And, of course, my first thought was, uh-oh, there go the frequent flyer miles. So we go to the airport, me and two big security guys, and they get on the plane with me. They stop by the cockpit, show the captain, the flight attendant, and the pilot that they are carrying weapons and authorized to do so. We go back to the back row of coach, the three seats in the middle where you can't even lean back, you know, because of the bulkhead. And I sit wedged between these two big guys for 4 hours, and we fly to California. As we're walking down the jetway, the flight attendant comes over and whispers something to one of them, and he just cracks up. And I said, Murph, what's so funny? He said, you know what she just said? She said, you know, I've been on these flights for 20 years, and that is the politest and best behaved prisoner that we have ever had. So that's why you do it, of course, is public appreciation. I want to share some thoughts with you today about our overall infrastructure with energy and oil as particular cases. But I think it's important for us to realize that we do have a very serious problem in more ways than one. And we got here by several different sets of influences on our path. One set of influences is that we spent much of the 1980s and 1990s being advised that we could make no mistake if we slimmed down our infrastructure, had everything delivered just in time, had a minimum number of hospital beds for predicted needs of the population, and so on. And so that's what we did. And therefore, on 9/11, when the bridge was closed to Canada, over which about a quarter of our international trade passes, Detroit had to stop making cars after a couple of days because the parts were all made in Canada. And there were two shock trauma beds available in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. Two. Empty. Two. So we have succeeded in a lot of ways in constructing an international trading system for energy and everything else that operates like a beautiful, fine Swiss watch, and it works very, very well as long as there's no interference. But whether it is a hurricane or a terrorist attack, we have serious problems with that infrastructure once something happens. Now, people who work in chaos theory and network theory talk about butterfly effects. This butterfly theoretically could flutter its wings on one side of the world. The ecosphere is a complex system, so it interacts in unpredictable ways. Rolling, cascading failure occurs, and one gets a tornado, say, on the other side of the world. Well, That seems kind of theoretical until you realize that 3 years ago, August, the tree branch fell in Ohio. And the city and much of the rest of the Northeast and Eastern Canada, some 80 million electricity consumers, lost power for a substantial period of time. The problem is that we not only have to deal with these so-called malignant effects, I call them that because it's somewhat akin to a natural disturbance of some sort occurring in a body and creating metastasis. We not only have to deal with malignant problems to this infrastructure, we have to deal with malevolent ones as well. Because what happened on 9/11 was not a tree branch falling. Terrorists are unfortunately a lot smarter than tree branches. What happened on 9/11 is that the 19 and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others who planned the operation figured out that short knives will get through baggage checks, figured out that American crews and passengers are trained to be polite to hijackers because that's what we did back in the 60s when we were just being flown to Cuba, and who wants to create a disturbance? You're just going to stay on the runway for a few hours. And that we had flimsy cockpit doors. Putting those three facts together made it possible not only for them to kill the people on the planes, but thousands of people in the buildings that were attacked as well. That's not a butterfly effect. That's war. That's getting inside our heads, understanding how our system and the infrastructures within our system work, and using them as weapons. Well, we have more than one set of problems along those lines, but energy is a big one. The electricity grid itself has a number of vulnerabilities, which I won't go into here unless people ask questions about it, but it is a network, sort of a confederation of local utilities and their grids that have been kind of spliced together, sort of, with the world's most baroque, no, that's not, the world's most rococo management and regulatory system. And it has substantial vulnerabilities because of that. But the electricity grid is at least here. If we can get ourselves organized with the federal regulators and the state regulators and the Canadian regulators and the Canadian companies and the American companies, because it's all one grid, basically east of the Rockies, except for Texas, which, of course, is not part of anybody's grid. But if we can work together with our Canadian neighbors, we could, in relatively short order, fix some of the substantial vulnerabilities in the electricity grid. It's not mainly a problem of technology. It's not even a huge problem of cost. It's mainly a problem of finding somebody who can get everybody together and get decisions made. But it is at least here. Oil is not. The oil infrastructure is all over the world. It is very heavily, of course, in that part of the world where two-thirds of the world's proven reserves lie, the Persian Gulf area and the wider Middle East. And there are choke points. For example, last February, Al-Qaeda attacked Abqaiq, the Saudi production facility in northeastern Saudi Arabia, through which about three-quarters of Saudi crude flows. There are sulfur clearing towers there. To get the sulfur out of Saudi crude, you have to do that with Saudi crude, even if you're going to ship it somewhere. It can't even go into a tanker before that is processed that way. So those clearing towers are a single failure point. My friend Bud McFarlane, who was President Reagan's national security advisor, said that he's seen some scenarios where terrorists fly hijacked aircraft into those towers, but he said, you know, you don't need an aircraft. He said, I'm an old Marine artilleryman, and I've been up there and seen those. He said, you could take those out with a decent mortar crew. So on that morning in February when the Saudi guards fought off the Al-Qaeda attackers, we're lucky that they didn't get within mortar range. Had they had a mortar and had they gotten within range, you were talking about 7 million barrels a day coming offline for probably well over 2 years and oil going up probably to the neighborhood of $200 a barrel. The oil system is full of infrastructure weaknesses of that sort. Abqaiq is one of the more dramatic. Another aspect of the problem that oil puts on our decision-making and our ability to conduct our affairs as we would like is what is called by Tom Friedman, the principle that the path of freedom and the price of oil run in opposite directions. It is not only Mr. Ahmadinejad, and it is not the funds that flow through Persian Gulf states, including particularly Saudi Arabia, to the Wahhabis of that part of the world, for them to run their madrasas in Pakistan and to teach the hatred that they teach. It is not only that, but highly priced oil gives Mr. Putin and Mr. Chavez a boost as well. Of the 14 leading oil exporters in the world, exactly two are democracies, Norway and Mexico. The rest are either dictatorships or authoritarian kingdoms. And we can talk some about how that has come about and why there is some pressure in those directions. But in any case, oil and high-priced oil make it harder for us to avoid genocide in Darfur because the Saudis, because the Sudanese have a deal with the Chinese with respect to oil. They make it harder for us to deal with Iran because China and Iran have an oil deal and so on and so on. We borrow about $320 billion, this year, to import oil. That doesn't count what we produce here domestically, but the 60% or so of our oil that we import, we borrow $320 billion a year, almost $1 billion every calendar day. And as those funds are shipped abroad, of course they put upward pressure on interest rates. Of course, it's the largest component of our trade deficit. If we have a problem with the dollar coming under strain because of our borrowing, think what happens to a country like Bangladesh, which is trying to finance its dollar-denominated oil imports with inexpensive foodstuffs or textiles as their exports. All of these factors together create a situation in which I would suggest we need to take some very special care in understanding how we can make some substantial changes in the transportation sector of our society. Now, oil, back in the 1970s, provided about 20% of our electricity. It now provides about 2%. And over most of the world, it's 7% or less. So oil is not a huge factor with respect to electricity generation. And therefore, the things that you do to change the way you produce electricity, whether it's to move to wind or to move to nuclear power or whatever, don't directly affect this oil issue, except for one important matter, to which I'll get in a second. So you can be a wind enthusiast or a nuclear power enthusiast or whatever, those are both perfectly reasonable ways to generate electricity, but they don't have much to do, at least in the first instance, with the oil debate. Oil is essentially two-thirds of it used for transportation, two-thirds of that for light vehicles that we all drive, and it is 98 to 99% of what we use to move ourselves around. Therefore, any event such as the terrorist attack on Oddcake that I described, or a Saudi decision, let's say, to turn on their reserve capacity and drive the price down, as they did in 1985, and again, other circumstances, recession in Asia and so forth, but to some extent they did it again in the late 1990s, has the effect of the structure of the oil market has the effect of making it possible for people to obtain huge returns for substantial periods of time, huge economic rents, well over and above what any normal return on investment would be. And then when competitors come along, the Sin Fuels Corporation, say, in the early 1980s, or perhaps ethanol today, for the reserve capacity to get opened up, turned on, price driven down, bankrupt the competitors. Some people believe that cannot be done today by the Saudis because of Mr. Simmons' theory about peak oil, that their fields are peaking, and also because of increasing and very substantial Chinese and Indian demand as those countries start producing middle classes and want automobiles. That may be true, but the Saudi reserve capacity at least maintains a threat, which investors pay a lot of attention to, because back there in the back of everybody's mind is, you know, we've been here twice before. We try to develop alternatives to oil, and it never seems to work. Why doesn't it work? Well, it doesn't work. It didn't work the first two times because of that reserve capacity and the price being driven down. So this structure of oil prices creates a unique way for oil to continue to dominate a huge sector of our economy, and to do it in a way in which people up until now have had very little luck in moving away from. Some new possibilities, however, exist. In the first instance, it seems to me that as we're looking at how we deal with oil, we have to deal with it in such a way that we are moving away from expenditures which require huge changes in our infrastructure and take a long time to manifest themselves in product. That was one of the problems of the Synfuels Corporation, and it's been one of the problems of a number of other alternatives. It's the problem with hydrogen fuel cells for passenger vehicles. Hydrogen fuel cells have some real uses, I think, as time goes on, with very large vehicles, with spaceships, with unmanned aerial vehicles, with remote sites and so forth. But not for passenger vehicles. One has to completely restructure the two largest industries in the world, energy and automobiles, and dovetail them so they work together just perfectly. And the hydrogen fueling stations and the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles all kind of come on the market at the same time and work together. Hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. If one looks instead at ways in which we can come up with alternatives to oil that are not susceptible to being undermined, as alternatives have been before, I would submit that we have to concentrate on a couple of things. First of all, very little change in infrastructure, and low cost, both for what has to be done to produce the fuels, and secondly, what has to be done in order to find the feedstocks for them. A few quick thoughts, and then let's turn to questions. One of the most interesting and exciting ideas in some time are plug-in hybrids. The president continues to talk about them a good deal, and he's right too. All one really needs is a battery with maybe four or five, six times the power density of the batteries that are in a Prius, say, today. And those batteries exist. They're in that kind of power density is what's in your computers, the small lithium-ion batteries. You have to make sure you build them in such a way that they don't catch fire. But that technology is reasonably mature. If you have, let's say, six times the power density in a battery, otherwise, in a Prius, just like the ones on the market now, you do have to make an investment in infrastructure if you are going to be able to drive at a penny a mile instead of the 10 to 20 cents a mile you pay with gasoline. You will need an extension cord. Each family who has a car would need as many extension cords as it has cars. Because by plugging in overnight, driving for, say, 20 miles on off-peak, very inexpensive electricity, at 1 to 2 cents a mile, you're doing a lot better than 10 to 20 cents per mile of gasoline. And as you do that, you are essentially turning your vehicle into something that gets net 110, 120 miles a gallon instead of 45 or 50, which a Prius would normally get. Now, you're doing something else. By propelling yourself around on fuel, electricity, that is so inexpensive, you are making it effectively impossible for the Saudis to drop the bottom out of the market and drive you out of business. They cannot compete, even with oil, if they took oil down to less than $5 a barrel. They can't compete with penny a mile off-peak overnight electricity. Now let's look at that. By the way, unlike a lot of other solutions for inexpensive transportation, this one has a huge section of American industry on its side, namely utilities, who are delighted at the prospect of being able to sell off-peak power at night and not need to add any new baseload. You do not need to add new power plants to run plug-in hybrids. The Electric Power Research Institute says you can have tens of millions of them on the road before you need any new baseload, new construction of power plants. So you are simultaneously offering an alternative, a cheap one, and making it very tough for the Saudis to undermine it as they did before. Are you doing anything with respect to global warming? Yes, and it's positive. You are reducing global warming gas emissions by a small percent. If you are in a very coal-heavy part of the grid, if you're an average part of the electricity grid, you're reducing them by 30 to 40%. If you're in California or Oregon or Washington State, which have very clean electric grids, you're reducing global warming gas emissions by 70 or 80 or 90%. So we now have a vehicle running along at 110, 120 miles per gallon. What else might be done? If we spend $37 per vehicle and put a different kind of plastic in the fuel lines, we have what's called a flexible fuel vehicle and can use up to 85% ethanol. One needs to reprogram the engine software kit. But the raw material cost is about $35 to $40. This is nothing to do. The Brazilians decided in 2003 they wanted to have all flexible fuel vehicles, and so the car company said, oh, okay. And they went from having 5% of their new cars being flexible fuel vehicles to 75% in 2 years. It's just not a problem. If one is running that hybrid that I described, it's a plug-in, on 85% ethanol, and there are now hundreds of stations in the country that produce ethanol, it will be cheaper as we move toward making it from cellulose, cellulosic feedstocks such as prairie grass, switchgrass, with genetically modified biocatalysts, instead of having to use somewhat more expensive corn. But if one is running that car I described on 85% ethanol, one is now getting well over 500 miles per gallon of petroleum products. Now this should be enough, I would think, to make a Wahhabi pay attention. We could, with systems that have been invented and are on the market now in different ways, begin before too long to move not just a little bit, but rather decisively away from oil as our principal transportation fuel. I would suggest that a path of that sort would be likely to get the attention of the countries in the Middle East whose misbehavior, either directly through their government or indirectly through a sect that is tied to them, such as the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, constitute a huge share of the world's difficulties as far as the future of conflict and the future of terrorism are concerned. An Iran or a Saudi Arabia that is not flush with wealth because of oil is potentially a very different country. It would take time. It's not going to happen immediately. But I would say that as we work the problem of dealing with terrorism itself, and as we work the problem of participating with our friends, I hope, in Europe and Muslims around the world in places like Indonesia who do not want, on the whole, to be terrorists or live in dictatorships or establish a worldwide caliphate, as we work with those against the Wahhabis, Al-Qaeda, Ahmadinejad and the Mazdiyazdi and the circle around them, the essentially theocratic, totalitarian, genocidal fanatics who constitute the Wahhabi, Al-Qaeda, and ruling circle of Iran's beliefs. I think as we're moving as best we can to win that war of ideas, if we're also moving toward well over 500 mile per gallon of petroleum product vehicles, we will have a dual approach that will serve us a lot better than what we are doing now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, on behalf of Middle East Forum. You consistently are at the cutting edge in these issues, and we are grateful to you for giving us your current thoughts on this as in so many other areas that you cover. Let me begin the question by asking, you present a very powerful case for making this transition. You've pointed out that such transitions have not taken place in the past. Is this underway? Are there major hurdles that need to be overcome? Are you working for some specific set of steps? Are there organizations that are doing this? Where do we stand?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot is going on because this is sort of a case in which the people and the private sector in the United States, everybody from 87 evangelical organizations to venture capitalists in California to agricultural interests, have all kind of started heading out in a direction compatible with this, at least. And it's more or less been larger companies and the government that is kind of been, on the whole, bringing up the rear and playing catch-up. But it is now, energy security, worded in somewhat different ways, is now by at least 20, 25 points the number one issue in the country. If you ask, give people a list of what they're concerned about, the economy, terrorism, war in Iraq, etc., and I have to pick one, something between 40 and 50% pick energy security. And if you give them a long list and say, pick the several that you think are the most important, energy security is always up there now at the top. People mean somewhat different things by it, but on the whole, they mean the sorts of things we've been talking about. You have the federal government's role under debate because our two great political parties tend to be ones in which the Republicans want to spend money on R&D and not have the government get into the market and not pick winners, and Democrats tend to be more inclined toward regulatory decisions and mandates and the like. I think we can get by this problem. First of all, because the plug-ins will do a lot to keep the Saudis from dropping the bottom out of the market. Secondly, you could have, with a relatively simple change, yet another arrow in your quiver in giving assurance to investors and keeping them Saudis from doing that, and that would be restructure the tax credit system, which now applies to ethanol and biodiesel and renewable diesel, and make it work in the following fashion, that it doesn't, there are no tax credits when oil is up at $60 a barrel, not needed. But if oil gets down to around $40 a barrel, then the credits for all of these fuels come into play, and they get larger as oil goes down. That makes it virtually impossible for the Saudis to do what they've done twice before. And an idea very much like that is one that Vinod Khosla, the venture capitalist in California who's been working on these issues for some time, has been promoting. The other main thing the government can do would be to insist on its vehicles being flexible fuel vehicles, plug-in hybrids, and to create a steadily increasing market to give the manufacturers every reason to move out in these directions. Most of what else you need is relatively easy to do. You need some type of mandate or tax incentive for there to be an adequate number of E85 stations. There are a few hundred out of the many tens of thousands of filling stations in the country now that sell E85. You need thousands instead of hundreds. But you don't really need a Manhattan Project. You need to incentivize continued research. But what's happening in this area now is like what was happening back at the dawn of the Internet. in Silicon Valley. You have a lot of really smart people who were doing other things are now kind of turning on to energy, to renewable energy, to not only oil substitutes, but substantial improvements recently in moving toward the thin film solar rather than having to have photovoltaic cells, which have to be manufactured in a very detailed fashion, clean rooms and so forth, like silicon chips. Now we're talking before long of being able to have solar panels that effectively the just a material put on top of your shingles and on your roof. So there are a number of things that people are doing to finance and to move out sharply on creative work in these areas. I think the key thing is that if we look back at American history and see where there have been very substantial positive changes in the economy, one of the great ones was the railroads. Was the Transcontinental Railroad, and the railroads had a huge amount to do with the industrialization of the United States. Well, the federal government had a very important, took a very important but limited role. Essentially, it made sure that no one could block the rights away. By the land grant system, it made sure there would be a right away. But the federal government didn't get into the business of designing the engines. And we don't need to do that either. What we need to do as a federal government, United States, is to keep the Saudis from dropping the bottom out of the market and to have everybody know that we're doing it and that there's no way they could do it. At that point, you'll see even more of what I saw a couple of weeks ago when I was in Silicon Valley, figuratively, not literally. You've got to make sure when you're standing on the street corner out there these days that you keep looking around, because otherwise some venture capitalist is going to knock you over as he's chasing an ethanol plant designer. There is a lot of action in this area now, and that's what we're good at. We're good at a lot of things as a country, but one of the things we're best at is producing those surges of creativity that we have seen on a number of other occasions, and you're starting to see it now in energy, I think.
Thank you, Jim. The floor is open. Let's start with Ziad Abdinur, who co-sponsored this afternoon's event with the forum.
Jim, based on your brilliant analysis, how do you recommend we move along dealing with the Saudis and the Iranians from a political point of view, a policy-making point of view?
Well, they're very different problems. I mean, Ahmadinejad's mentor, this guy, Mesut Yazdi, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he was exiled, to kicked out of the government, essentially, when Khomeini came in, and he heads up a school in Qom. And the reason was because Khomeini thought he was too radical. Okay, this is Ahmadinejad's mentor. Now, I think that when this circle, I believe they call it justice, the circle of kind of a cult in a way around Mesut Yazdi and Ahmadinejad, comes more into power. Let's say they're able to make, after Khamenei, make Mesut Yazdi be the next supreme leader. We really don't, we're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, we are talking with a people who are really committed to the idea that if they can just get enough deaths concentrated in time, the Mahdi will hear and will return from, I guess, the 9th century and will preside at the battles that will end the world. This is the program. Now, to our very great shame as a Western society, most of us back 60, 70 years ago took a look at the program of the Third Reich and said, yeah, it's crazy. We don't have to worry too much about that. I think it pays to listen to what these totalitarian movements say and apparently what Ahmadinejad wants is a massive war, perhaps from his point of view, nuclear is better than not, in the Middle East. There, I would do everything we possibly could to undermine that regime. We've been saying it on the Committee of the Present Danger for some time. Michael Dean, a lot of other people have written about it, ways you can do it with sanctions, with particularly of their imports of refined petroleum products. There are a number of things one could do, but we have been very hesitant as a country and haven't really decided what we want to do with Iran. I think people here who know more about it than I might disagree. I think there might have been a window between the spring of 97 when Khatami came in and the spring of 98 when the crackdown really got tough. There may have been a window that there could have been some way we might have worked with them. I don't know. But if so, it was at least over by the spring of 98. And so Iran, as far as I'm concerned, is just an out-and-out enemy. And we have to figure out the best thing we can do to undermine it and to weaken its government and keep it from getting nuclear weapons. Even, and I agree with John McCain on this, the worst option is, of course, to use force against them, except for one, and that is letting them have a nuclear weapon. I think we simply can't do that. Now, Saudi Arabia's a different case. The House of Saud is this ancient kingdom, and only really a couple of generations out of desert Bedouin, and we have different types of relations with different kings in different parts of the House of Saud. If King Abdullah were a sprightly 65 instead of 85, I would be a little more optimistic, because from time to time he does try some reforms. He put in a better education minister a couple of year and a half ago and got turned around very quickly from what I here by Prince Nayef, the interior minister, who is about as friendly to Wahhabis as anybody could possibly be. If Nayef should end up becoming king after Abdullah, it would be like going from an aged Gorbachev to Andropov as your ruler of the Soviet Union. So the situation in the kingdom is complicated. In best of all circumstances, we're able to work with them to some extent and try to get them to lean on the Wahhabis doing what they do around the world. But it's a terrible problem. The situation, as far as I'm concerned, with Saudi Arabia is somewhat like the situation that would exist if we took late 15th century Spain with Ferdinand and Isabella and Torquemada running the Spanish Inquisition, and somehow magically picked it up and moved it up to the early 21st century, drilled down and discovered 25% of the world's oil underneath it. And then Ferdinand and Isabella turn to Torquemada and they say, "Torque, look, we don't have any problem with your burning these Jews and dissident Christians and Muslims and stealing their money. That's all fine. You keep doing it as far as we're concerned. We understand that you'd like to spread your system all over the world and effectively take over everything from the Catholic Church. That's fine with us too. We've got several billion dollars a year we're willing to help you out with. Just leave us alone, okay?" And he says, "Cool." That's what George Shultz means when he says that the relationship between the House of Saud and the Wahhabis is a, quote, grotesque protection racket. That's what he means. And that is a very different kind of problem than the one we have with Iran. It's not easy. It's not as if we're dealing with some cuddly, friendly country over there. I mean, but it's a different kind of problem than we have with Iran.
Thank you very much. I wonder how you feel about, and I think the American public feels about, increasing our nuclear energy. I mean, we all remember Three Mile Island, but I understand the nuclear cities are much more efficient and much less vulnerable.
I think this is almost purely a cost issue. That is, if it's cheaper to use coal in an integrated gasification combined cycle, new clean coal facility, capture and sequester the carbon, than it is to have new plants be nuclear. Or if we can figure out a way to get the transmission costs down, we've got either South Dakota or North Dakota has enough wind, if stored properly in batteries and transmitted, to fuel the entire electrical system of the United States. So there's a lot of wind, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper to make electricity from it these days. It's just stranded out there in places where there are relatively few people. So I think as long as you're doing something that's not adding to global warming gas emissions, and none of those three would, it seems to me it's essentially a cost issue. But nuclear in the world, as distinct from just in the United States with our 104 power plants, nuclear in the world is a very serious problem, even as a source of electricity, because the treaty regime that we operate under, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, all essentially grew out of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program in the 50s. And so the regime is all structured in such a way as to promote the development and refinement of nuclear power. Even while they're feuding with Iran, the IAEA is obligated to, and it does, have people in Iran helping them work on making their reactors work better and so forth. That's part of the international agreement. As long as you can get into the fuel cycle on nuclear power, that is, reprocess the plutonium or enrich uranium, you effectively are a nuclear weapon state. All you have to do is keep those systems going so that you have enough plutonium to make something about the size of a soccer ball, or enough highly enriched uranium to make something about the size of a basketball, and then some basic engineering, portions of which are pretty well accessible on the web, and you have a nuclear weapon. So if we try to move toward nuclear power as a worldwide solution for generating a new generation of electricity without global warming gas emissions, we right away run up against the fact that we really don't want to do that under the current treaty regime. We want to do it in such a way that we establish some international facility to reprocess fuel and enrich uranium or something and keep that capability out of the hands of individual states, particularly ones like Iran and North Korea. To me, that's the big problem with nuclear energy. It's not that we can't design perfectly fine plants, and given our own chaotic political system, we'll argue about, you know, the Yucca Mountain and all that, but ultimately we'll find some way to store our own spent fuel and so forth. That, to me, that's not the problem. The problem is the international regime.
I have two questions. The Islamic fundamentalist has been really rising over the past 25 years, which is at least the time when we already knew that we had to become independent of the oil of the Middle East. And the car that you're talking about, which is, of course, a fantastic idea, has been available in countries like Brazil since at least the 80s. So why haven't we worked on this already then? The second question is, do you think that if Saddam Hussein was still here with Iraq, the Iraq that from before, it would be a shield against a rising powerful Iranian regime?
Well, yeah. And the second question first. In a sense, I mean, Stalin's Soviet Union was a shield, and we were glad to have it against Nazi Germany. I mean, we were allied for 3 years and 8 months with, at that point, history's greatest murderer. Stalin had killed more people than anybody at that point, and we were glad to have him as an ally. It's, you know, raison d'etat. Sometimes one has to link up with some pretty unattractive people in order to defeat other really unattractive people. I don't know whether we would be in better shape with Saddam still there, and I somehow doubt it. I still think there's a chance that things can work out better than they appears to be the case right this minute in Iraq. But it's a reasonable argument between reasonable people, and sometimes in extremists one has to make a common cause with bad folks against other bad folks. I would have hoped we would not have had to have done that again. We did it in the 80s with Saddam because of the hideous nature of his regime. Now, as far as vehicles are concerned, flexible fuel vehicles haven't been around all that long. What the Brazilians tried to do at first, and the reason they were on the rocks and really not going anywhere with their ethanol program, was they tried to have separate cars, alcohol cars and gasoline cars, and the system basically wasn't working. When the Saudis in the mid-80s, and again, as I said, in the late 90s, would drive the price down, and it would effectively completely destabilize their ethanol business, and it was almost dead a few years ago when they made the decision to move toward flexible fuel vehicles, which in Brazil can run on 100% gasoline, 100% ethanol, or anything in between. For us, we stop at E85, 85% ethanol, because we need 15% gasoline for cold weather starting up here. They don't have that much cold weather problem in Brazil. So you can pull into a filling station now, it's been true for the last few years, in Brazil, and buy either álcool, alcohol, ethanol, or gasoline, and compare the prices and mix them, and which one. That essentially is using a flexible fuel vehicle as one component of this thing I described, gives us a similar type of possibility. It brings choice into the system. If you have a flexible fuel vehicle, you can either fill up with E85 or you can fill up with gasoline, up to you. We're not going to encourage mixing them that much for reasons having to do with the emissions, but it would bring to us the kind of flexibility that Brazil has been able to bring about over the course of the last few years. And you know, bless the Brazilians. If we end up making this all work, it will be in at least an important measure, not overwhelming measure, but important measure to the fact that people have seen what the Japanese have been able to do with the hybrid and seen what the Brazilians have been able to do with alcohol as fuel and say, you know, we can do this. And that's important, and it's useful.
Could you say a word about the Brazilian agricultural infrastructure that is?
Yes. Brazil's ethanol production facilities are down near Sao Paulo, and it's a part of the world that is ideally suited to the planting and harvesting of sugar cane. They're not tearing down the forests to the rainforest to produce ethanol. They are sometimes tearing down the rainforest, but it has to do with other things, cattle grazing and so forth. But down there in Sao Paulo, things are ideally suited. They have, because of the climate, they have a double growing season. Sugarcane only needs to be replanted about once every 7 years or so. So they have these giant machines that just go through the fields and harvest the sugarcane, and then they drive over to the ethanol plant, which is right in the middle of the sugarcane fields. They don't have any power coming in. They don't have electricity. They don't have natural gas. They don't have oil. Any of that. They use the gas, what's left over after the cane is harvested, the lignin, the structural woody part of the plant, to fire up their ethanol plants, just the way a hillbilly in my home state of Oklahoma might have used corn stalks and corn stover to burn underneath his still. Then what comes out is molasses and ethanol. And they put it in tanks and drive it away. It works fine. They're producing ethanol now at about 60 cents a gallon. They pay a 51 cent tax tariff that we levy on them when it shows up in the United States, and they still are able to sell it at a profit, a small one, at today's gasoline prices. So, they're showing the way. We can do pretty well with corn, a little more expensive than their sugar. And our cellulosic ethanol from switchgrass, prairie grass, and so forth will be a little bit more expensive still for a while. But what it does is it makes it possible for the feedstocks to be grown most anywhere. This prairie grass, switchgrass, is what kind of covered the continent before we showed up. And they it's a perfectly fine set of plants that do what you need to, and they replenish the soil. You know, you're not talking about putting land into cultivation and ruining it and so forth. You can, for most of what you need, you can just harvest the grasses that are today on the soil bank lands where farmers get paid to plant things like prairie grass in order to replenish the soil. You just mow them once or twice a year and turn them into ethanol. So we can do something similar. It won't be quite as cheap as what the Brazilians are doing, but we could be very close within a very few years.
And around the world, is there the capacity to produce?
Yes. I was on a television show in India a year and a half ago, and I just happened that afternoon in Bombay to go by Gandhi's home. And I had not focused on the fact that in addition to what all Americans think of Gandhi in identifying him with independence and with the passive resistance, satyagraha, The third major component of his national strategy for India is symbolized by that spinning wheel in the middle of the Indian flag, which was local self-sufficiency. And when you explain to Indian audiences that we're working on technology which would make it possible for Indian villages to produce their own tractor fuel, their own transportation fuel, they get very, very positively inclined. What this is all about is not just transportation fuel. We are starting to see from DuPont and Cargill and other big companies using first corn-based cellulose, corn-based sugars, and now beginning, at least in the laboratory, cellulosic materials to produce plastics, to produce rugs, to produce other types of things that now are produced from hydrocarbons. What we're talking about here is not just ethanol. We're talking about butanol and renewable diesel and polylactic acid, the whole kind of concept over time of biorefineries helping the world make a transition from hydrocarbons to carbohydrates. And that has all sorts of advantages from the point of view of global warming gases and so on, but it also has a huge advantage from the point of view of rural populations, whether in the U.S. or otherwise. I'm sure it's even more dramatic in Bangladesh, but in the U.S., remember I said $320 billion a year is what we borrow just to import oil. Well, if you take a quarter of that, $80 billion a year, that imported oil and produce it domestically in the U.S., you're roughly going to be producing somewhere close to $80 billion worth of goods and services in the U.S. as a whole. Some of it will be rural, some will be elsewhere. But $80 billion last year was net farm income in the U.S. By taking a quarter of our imported oil and producing it domestically from fuels, we are essentially doubling what farmers made. Now, that won't all go to farmers, but a chunk of it will. And if you want to replace half of the oil, then you're trebling what net farm income in the U.S. Again, it'll be distributed around the country because some of it will go to ethanol plant producers of equipment and things like that. This has a lot of opportunity for agricultural parts of the world, not only here, but all over the world.
Time for one more quick question or one more quick answer. Yes? Please.
Are you saying that I should not invest in oil sands from California and that we shouldn't drill in the Gulf?
No. The oil sands mainly are Canadian. In Alberta, and the oil shale, which would be probably somewhat more expensive to extract, is mainly a Western United States phenomenon. Although most of it is in Colorado, I think there's some in California. We're going to need fuel from liquid sources of that sort for a long time as we make this transition. But I think what's key about these other technologies is that if you can produce oil or gasoline, let's say, and diesel from tar sands for something in the ballpark of $30-$35 a barrel when oil is at about that, it's probably going to be quite competitive because that's kind of where ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, is likely to be. I think that the less expensive of these alternative fuels tend to be in that $30-$35 a barrel range. Would be, I think, something that would be likely to be productive for a long time. If it's only affordable with oil up at $70-$90 a barrel, and some of these alternatives are like that, then you've got a different problem. But the main point I want to leave you with is this business of this coalition. I call it, people are interested in all this, I call it a coalition between the tree huggers, the do-gooders, the sod busters, the cheap hawks, the evangelicals, and Willie Nelson. And and I think a grouping of that unlikeliness has some promise. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James Woolsey, for the brilliant analysis. And at times I was thinking, here we are off in sugar cane, but it's all very much related to our mission, which is to understand the Middle East and to find American policies to deal with the Middle East. And I think there's nothing more important than the issue you have so comprehensively dealt with today. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. I'd like to mention that on November 2nd in New York, we have David Price Jones speaking for us. I think you have the announcement before you. We hope you'll join us again. He'll be talking about he'll be talking about his new book called Betrayal, which is France, the Arabs, and Israel. I think you'll find that of interest. He's a very well-spoken analyst. And I thank Scott Rosenblum again for the use of this wonderful facility, and thank Kramer Levin for hosting us. And I wish you all a good day.